This podcast is made possible by your support and your donations. Thank you. And by the purchase of my book called Everyday Buddhism, Real Life Buddhist Teachings and Practices for Real Change. I will post an affiliate link to the book on Amazon in the show notes. And if you've already read it, please take a minute to rate and review. And also consider purchasing it again for a friend or family member as a gift. Welcome to Everyday Buddhism, making every day better by applying the proven tools found in Buddhist concepts. Welcome to episode 107 of Everyday Buddhism, making every day better. In this episode, I talk with Oren J. Sofer about his new book, Your Heart Was Made for This, Contemplative Practices for Meeting a World in Crisis with Courage, Integrity, and Love. Oren teaches meditation and communication internationally. He holds a degree in comparative religion from Columbia University and is a certified trainer of nonviolent communication and a somatic experiencing practitioner for the healing of trauma. Oren has practiced meditation in the early Buddhist tradition since 1997, beginning his studies in Bodh-Gaya, India, and later spending 2.5 years living as a renunciate at branch monasteries in the Ajahn Chah Thai forest lineage. He is a longtime student of Joseph Goldstein, Michelle McDonald, and Ajahn Susido, and is a member of the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. Oren is also the author of the bestseller, Say What You Mean, A Mindful Approach to Nonviolent Communication, and 2 books on teaching mindfulness to adolescents, The Mindful Schools Curriculum for Adolescents, and Teaching Mindfulness to Empower Teens. His teaching has reached people around the world through online communication courses and guided meditations, combining classical Buddhist training with the accessible language of secular mindfulness. In our conversation in this episode, we talked about, among other things, how our hearts really are made for these times. Our hearts were made to awaken. And if we can practice in small steps, turning toward suffering, we can enter a portal to transformation. We talk about how the world shapes our hearts in ways not best for us, and how we can practice shaping our own hearts in a productive way. How getting in touch with our true values will guide us through these challenging times, and how we need to consciously change the channel of our thoughts to be more aligned with our true values. There is something profoundly soothing in listening to Oren teach. I know you will come away from this episode feeling positive and hopeful about how we all can change through the contemplative practices Oren teaches in this wonderful book. The conversation starts now. Hi, Oren. Thank you so much for joining me today on this podcast. I am honored.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
You know, I shared your bio in the episode intro, but for listeners who may not be aware, can you sort of give them a brief intro into your Buddhist and contemplative journey in life?
Sure. How far back do you want to go?
I think I used the adjective brief, so whatever.
Okay, brief, right.
Whatever you think works to put it all together for us.
Yeah. I started meditating in college. I entered the Buddhist path first through some academic courses, reading and getting interested in Asian thought and philosophy. and then had the good fortune of studying abroad in India and actually living and practicing at a Burmese Buddhist monastery in Bodh Gaya. And I was deeply moved and taken from the very beginning and have been practicing ever since. So I've trained in the Burmese Satipatthana, the Western lineage of the Thai forest tradition, as well as with a Sri Lankan teacher who practices a more sort of open kind of mindfulness tradition. And along the way, kind of complemented the Buddhist practice with other modalities like nonviolent communication, Peter Levine's somatic experiencing for trauma healing, looking at issues of patriarchy, oppression, and power relationships as my own sort of relational awareness has grown, which is more folded into my more recent book, as you're familiar with. Yeah, and I just feel really blessed and grateful to have been on this journey.
Yeah, that's great. The diversity that I think you bring is very evident in this book as well. Well, your first book as well, but the diversity to compared to some other Buddhist teachings that we've seen in the past few years that focus on, you know, how to find resilience in these horrible times. And, you know, you come at it from a slightly different angle, which I really did appreciate. Mm. I wanted to share with you, I didn't share with you prior to recording, so I'll share with you now. I thought your book was so important for the world today. And that being one of the reasons is that you bring a different perspective to this, you know, you got to have resilience, you got to do this, which just adds, I think, a little more pressure to the whole thing that we're going through. So it was so important that I selected it. You know, I have a Sangha and a community, and I selected your book as the second book club feature in our newly launched book club segment that we started late last year.
Cool.
Late last year, we did Householder Koans with Eve Marco Roshi. And this book I just thought was good because it has such an emphasis on practice. Now, this is partly my striving to get people to quit reading and doing a little practice. Not sure how well it's going to go, but hey. But I wanted to tell you on a personal note that I've been using it to practice because I found it so helpful. And I'll tell you a little more about how that all works in, but I'll give you two questions to kick us off here.
Okay.
First, can you talk more about your inspiration for the book and its unique structure? Because I do think it has a slightly unique structure, as I hinted at before. And next, about the title, you know, Your Heart Was Made for This, which, of course, doesn't really feel like any of our hearts were made for any of this. It's like, say what?
Right. Absolutely.
Because our hearts had kind of hardened, I think, over the past 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever years it's been. But maybe it's just we are out of touch with the love that our hearts naturally hold. So those are the two questions. I hope that's not too much to remember, but there you go. Dive in.
Not at all. Thanks. Yeah, it does feel like things have been kind of relentless the last few years. And that's a little bit why I wrote the book. The initial inspiration for the book came during 2020, when I think the ground shifted underneath all of us, right? It started with the pandemic when the reality of interdependence shifted from a concept, a spiritual experience, to a day-to-day practical impact. And all of the humans on the whole planet recognized, whoa, we really do depend on each other and things can change unexpectedly very quickly. And then that was followed, particularly here in the United States and in various ways around the world, by the spiritual and cultural and political upheaval of the movement for Black Lives.
Yeah.
Followed by the climate crisis breaking into public consciousness for many who had not been following it so closely in a new way with the wildfires out west. And so it was a difficult year. It was an intense year. And as a meditation teacher, one of the ways that I felt that I could contribute was by writing and speaking about the things that make our hearts stronger, and how to not just cope and get by, but actually find our balance and respond to what was happening all around us. That was the initial impetus. And then the project took on a new meaning about a year later when my wife and I got pregnant. And I started looking at these questions of what is the role of contemplative practice in our modern world from a different lens, and thinking about our son's life and future generations in a very different way, in a very personal and intimate way. And so the book became also a very personal investigation into this question of what is the relevance of contemplative practice in these modern times? And is it more than just something to attend to our own personal suffering? And the answer is very much a resounding yes. But that was the inspiration for the book. So I'll pause there before answering your second question and see if there's anything you want to comment or follow up on.
Yeah. You actually answered both of those questions. Great. And it's like, you know, I think we were all struggling to find some sort of life raft or at that time. One thing I did want to comment on when you said it was sort of interdependence hitting home. Mm-hmm. And we did have that, but unfortunately, I think we lost it, which is what caused so much angst, mm-hmm. I think, in these last couple of years. It seems like instead of, you know, there was that brief time where we all felt like one big family, one global mm-hmm. family. Mm-hmm. And then lately we're all at each other's throats, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that didn't help the heart. That helped to harden our hearts a little more rather than soften them. But
yeah,
but you know, I will say that, but you know, I think that's the key to, you know, if you look at the broad Buddhist tradition, whatever, you know, Theravada and the mm-hmm. forest tradition, you know, mm-hmm. Vipassana, Mahayana, Tibetan mm-hmm. Buddhism, I don't care where it is, both mm-hmm. in the Pali canon and in the Mahayana path, mm-hmm. the focus has been on cultivating the mind heart or
yes,
or reduce, so that we can reduce our suffering and reduce the suffering that we bring about to others. There's so much written in the sutras across the traditions about taking hold of or taming our minds and emotions. Mm-hmm. Bringing it home to me, then I want to, you know, filter it back to you to answer more on this is, you know, I mentioned to you earlier, I spent 2 decades studying in the Tibetan tradition mm-hmm. before coming to Bright Dawn lay ministry training. And one of the books that I have consistently used as a guide my whole life has been The Way of the Bodhisattva by the 8th century scholar Shantideva.
Yes.
That's the Dalai Lama's favorite book. I think it may be one of mine, if not my favorite books, because I always refer to it. Mm. Now, I want to say, and I'm not schmoozing you here, but your book has the same feel to me as Shantideva's.
Wow, that's quite a compliment.
Well, it's not in the structure or the writing, because he wrote in verse. If you could have written in verse, that would have been amazing.
and shorter. He's very pith.
Yeah, he is very pith. But in the way it acknowledges, you know, from a very personal perspective, the troubles our mind, our emotions, our body get us into. Right. If we don't take a hold of them and cultivate them and train them.
Yeah.
And so there's two verses that I wanted to bring out because I think it's amazing. And a verse from Shantideva and a line from your book, which to me are like cousins, brothers, sisters, whatever.
Yeah.
A verse in Shantideva's writings that always have captivated me, and it's how I get people to study Shantideva, is his verse is, I am as if benumbed by sorcery, as if reduced to total mindlessness. I do not know what dulls my wits, or what is it that has me in its grip? Okay, and you wrote, if we do not shape the heart,
Yes.
The world will do it for us, and
Right.
the world does not have our highest welfare in mind.
That's right.
I think it's that world taking our hearts is what has Shantideva in its grip. If we weren't aware of all of this before, the last 5, 10 years has certainly provided the evidence of how our hearts can be broken and our minds poisoned by the way the world controls us. But Shanti David didn't have the internet and social media,
Right.
so he wasn't even dealing with that.
Right.
So you talked about all this, framing the practice while echoing back to the Buddha and his words of encouragement, right, to take back control our minds and hearts. So I know this is a long way around it, but can you speak to all of this a little bit? Because I think it dovetails into why you wrote the book.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? The relationship between our inner life and what we experience as the outer world, and how the structures, the institutions, the technology of our outer world feed upon what we call the kilesa, these deeply rooted harmful patterns in the psyche of greed, hate, and delusion. How the sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Accumulated history of patriarchy, colonialism, racism, anti-Semitism, all of the different ways that humans have been divided from one another and relating to one another through domination, control, and violence. Some theorize that patriarchy is the original form of oppression, that the separation along lines of sex and gender. And the oppression of women is kind of the first instance of this pattern of domination and control, because in a matrilineal society, it's very clear where the lineage exists. In a patrilineal society, in order to maintain a patrilineal descent, you need to control the women. And so there comes the domination and the violence and the control, and then the oppression of children is the next. Is that, the adults, we force children into fitting into our world instead of recognizing that they are experiencing the world in a different way. Anyway, I've kind of gone down a rabbit hole now here, and I'm trying to get back
No,
to the question
feel
you
free.
asked. So the inner and the outer. So we start to recognize that the suffering we experience is not only, in our own psyche, but that the experiences that we have every day and the things we interface with in our society and our world, are actually affecting us. And it's the analogy that I use is it's like driving a vehicle that's misaligned. And the vehicle pulls in a certain direction, and that pull is the pull of modern society, and that pull is shaped. One of the most predominant forces today is the global economy, which is molding all of us to be unconscious consumers and to believe that our sense of wholeness, belonging, well-being, success, dignity, worth are all tied to how much we accumulate and how much we can purchase or obtain. And of course, it's not that there's something romantic about poverty, and that there isn't a basic minimum quality of life and certain amount of happiness and satisfaction that comes from having our material needs met. That's not what I'm saying. But the delusion that is fed by marketing, advertising, and a capitalist economy, this vision of limitless growth, in the sense that in order for me to be whole and happy, I need to have more. So, all of this pulls on our psyche, and that distortion is so insidious and prevalent that it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in. Right. We don't even notice it. And so if we don't actively counter that force, that those external forces, and I'm speaking about the economy earlier, I was referencing the way that systems of domination and oppression kind of pit us against one another and create this experience of believing that we need to dominate one another if we're going to be safe or have enough. If we don't actively recognize those forces, we become a part of them. They shape us. So to counter them, we need to apply a force in the opposite direction. Yeah. We need to take that active role of taking responsibility for our own clarity, our own well-being, and the potency of our own hearts, our own psyches, and engaging in a process of reshaping them in alignment with our values and with our vision for the future that we want to create for ourselves and our world.
Yeah, the key point of there is, first of all, being aware that you need to do that, which you you address in one of the first qualities, which we'll talk about it, the qualities a bit in attention, but also, you know, alignment with your own values, which you that's that where the world sort of steals that alignment away from you, right?
It's
I suppose we let it happen, and it really, but it's pretty seductive and pretty hard to fight as it's happening.
Yeah.
You sometimes only notice it as it already happened, and then you're too deep into it, and then it's a struggle, right?
Yeah. you asked two questions that I didn't quite answer yet, and I'll try to do this briefly. One was about the title. And so the title has two meanings for me. There's an outer meaning and an inner meaning. And the outer meaning is that kind of slightly provocative, hopeful message that whatever it is we're facing, whether it's some personal crisis or a collective global crisis, what if instead of believing that I need to get away from this, I need to immediately resolve or fix this, what if it were rather a doorway to our liberation? What if our heart was actually made for whatever is unfolding in the present moment? And this is, as we both know, a kind of core teaching in the Dharma to develop the resources inside to turn towards what is happening as a portal to transformation. Now, that's the outer meaning, because there's also a way, as you indicated, that some of the things we're facing, but really, our hearts were not made for this. Like, on a very real objective level, our nervous systems weren't designed to exist in the modern world with the technology, the pace, the demands, the isolation. We were designed to exist and live in a very different context. So what were our hearts made for then? This is where the inner meaning for me is this invitation to recognize that. And the word heart, of course, means more than just emotions. It's really referring to like our psyche, this chitta, this heart mind. We were made to awaken. We were made to live into the potential of all of these powerful, beautiful, transformative capacities we have as human beings for courage, for generosity, for compassion, for resolve and energy and determination, all of these potent capacities. So that's the meaning of the title. And then the structure of the book, the structure, it's almost like a fractal. There are these nested structures within it. Like, you know, each chapter is short enough that you can read it in one sitting.
Yeah.
But it's long enough that there's something to chew on for a week or two and really digest. And at the end of the chapter, there is an invitation to reflection, something to think about, something to turn over in your mind, to meditate on, if that's what you feel called to sit quietly and actually investigate your own experience, and then to action, to actually do something concrete and specific in your life. That's the structure within the chapter. And then each part of the book follows this arc of energy and development that we see in the Buddha's teachings, that we see in the five jhanic factors, the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of awakening, this wave-like structure of building energy, reaching a peak, and then integrating and settling and into release and freedom. And then the whole arc of the book has those four parts, each of which invites us to experience that that wave-like structure from a different perspective, in a different way, you know, looking at the core movement of energy, the different manifestations it takes in our bodies, our relationships in our life with friends and other people who inspire, support us, and then our experience of being at home in the world and what home means for us on a spiritual level and also on a material level. So those are some of the structures in the book.
Yeah, I love the structure, actually. It was, like I said, I'm using it to practice, and I'm also guiding the book club in doing the practice. You know, what was one of my questions was going to be how those 26 qualities work together, but they do work together, much like the Eightfold Path. You know, they're not linear in that you have to do this one first, although attention is a pretty good way to start. You have to do this one first, and then the next one. It's right. Sort of like this holistic, continuous circle that reinforces each other. Like you called it a fractal, but I think
beautiful. Yeah,
that's what I feel when I work with the book. When I first of all read the book through, and then as I'm working through it myself, it's like, you know, I keep circling. We just started the book, so I'm trying to practice with my book club. We just started the book, and we're just on the second
chapter.
Yeah, the second chapter or factor.
Yeah, aspiration.
And I keep finding how the attention and the aspiration keep circling around each other. Mm-hmm, you know, it's like what I journaled on by my reflection in attention, I keep calling up in my aspiration as oh, I identified these values, and that's what I can use as my aspiration. So I just love that.
Great.
I think it works well. So as I'm hinting at that, I read a lot of books for this podcast, and mostly I'm reading them to interview the authors, and we talk about some of their what they write, and I gain a lot of wisdom from each one of them, and I incorporate it into my daily life and practice. But I have to say, your book came just at the right time for me to use as a dedicated practice. You offered some hope and pleasant anticipation for what this practice could bring. In this one quote I loved, you said, "We may not recognize it, but we are always practicing something. Our thoughts, words, and actions shape us. Each one creates a trickle of water flowing downhill, carving a channel in the fertile soil of our heart and mind. If you practice feeling anxious, stressed, and agitated, you etch those grooves deeper." Well, I can certainly testify to that. I have battled the demon of preoccupation with the negative for quite a number of years. It started with political changes in the 2016 and continued to escalate with the pandemic. And in my personal case, I had a distinct threat from the pandemic in that I'm immunocompromised. And well, in 2020, I was younger, but right now I'm 71 years old. But either case, I was an elder. So that put me on a too high risk territory, which made me, it actually reactivated old traumas I didn't even know I had. Okay, so traumas that I was living with and didn't even know I had. And I wouldn't have been able to rescue myself from that if it wasn't for the combination of working with a therapist and working with Buddhist practice. But what it did was, even though I'm way better, it's still, and as you know, you've talked about, worked with trauma, and it trauma keeps you hyper vigilant. You know, you're always looking out for the thing that's going to get you again, right? And so I have been trying to shake that for the last 4 years with mixed success. So I wanted to thank you, Oren, for throwing me another life raft to sail away from my focus on the negative and practice using love as a guide and practice connecting to my true values. Because as you said, we need to change the channel. That's that getting out of that groove. And it's so very hard to do in this, like you said, all the factors around us that make us stay in that groove. You know, I found myself, despite my Buddhist practice, I mean, it doesn't solve everything. Keep going back to the hypervigilance, which means the negative. So these practices are helping. And so thank you. I don't know what else if you wanted to say about that, but
yeah, I mean, changing the channel is a essential skill for us in life, and of course, it needs to be understood and utilized wisely, right? Because we can use it as an avoidance or an escape, which is not what you're talking about. You're talking about a very clear and important intervention to create the conditions we need to practice, to enjoy our lives, right? It's like attending to that echo of threat. That is a trauma where we are actually not living in the present because we are hearing this reverberation in our nervous system of the past and still experiencing it in the here and now as if it were real. So changing the channel is a versatile and powerful tool that lets us direct our attention, that lets us do that first step of becoming aware. We use mindfulness to become aware of what we are attending to externally, internally, and then we can use that skill to evaluate and say, wait, this is not helpful. This is not useful. This is not where I want to place my attention right now and put it somewhere else. And that takes training. It takes training, as we know, to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you think you know these things and you do at a conscious level, but if you don't keep practicing, drilling down, drilling down, drilling down, doing these things, you don't really change the channel. You know, you just keep going back to habit, which is the wrong place you want to end up. And that sort of links to this. In the book, you focused on 26, I'll call them good qualities. They're developmental qualities to transform our mind, heart, and change that channel. But as sort of like in meditation, you know, when people first meditate and, you know, they say, oh, this is terrible because it's making my mind crazy. Well, it's like what it is making their attention on their mind, which was always crazy. They just weren't aware of it. And so one of the things about focusing on these good qualities, and you brought this up in the book, is sometimes your afflictive qualities break through your afflictive emotions, you know, greed, anger, and delusion, break through because maybe you've been bearing them or whatever. But when you're focusing on like if you're focusing on love, then you might find anger and hatred coming through. And you know, when you focus on some of the other things, you see other things rising to the top in your mind. And that's just because we're paying attention to it. So that it feels like self-sabotaging, but it's not. It's if we focus on it and work through it, we can break through it. How can you talk to more how we can work through that negative stuff at the same time we're working through the positive stuff?
That's such an important question, Wendy. And it's something that I gave a lot of thought to as I wrote the book, because as you said, those painful places, they do break through. And it's not like we always are able to just change the channel. And whether it's fear or grief or anger or self-judgment, they're powerful. And for many of us at different times, they are constant companions, or they can be. And so there are different ways, I think, that we can develop to attend to these challenges. One of the key things that I offer at the beginning of the book, and then try to bring back again and again and again as we go through these different healing transformative traits, is these principles of trauma-informed practice. And whether or not one suffers from trauma in a classical sense, I think that many of the things that haunt us in our lives have this trance-like quality that is similar to trauma, where we get pulled into it and we can't get out. Mm-hmm. There's a loss of agency that we experience. And so the principles that I discuss in the book, the first is to begin as much as possible from a place of relative safety. Mm-hmm. And that is no small feat in today's world.
Yeah.
That so takes true. A lot of work just to do that. And so this is where so many of the practices and tips and tools and suggestions I offer throughout the book come in handy, where it's like just the simple practice of orienting to our environment that comes from Peter Levine's work, noticing and connecting with our senses, yeah, or remembering and engaging with direct present moment experiences that are nourishing or soothing. Having a cup of tea, looking out of the window, drawing, listening to music, anything, taking a hot bath or shower, if you know you have the privilege and the blessing of having hot running water,
right?
You know, as so many in our world do not have today, but spending time with a friend, taking a walk, yeah, massaging yourself, like watering the plants with attention and care, like anything that brings us out of these sort of like distorted filters, yeah, that color our experience of ourselves and our life. We need to be rooted in the present moment and come back to something that feels okay enough. And so this is the first principle of any trauma-informed practice, is you gotta attend to the dislocation that's occurring in the heart and come back to some sense of relative okayness and balance, and to find our own way to do that. So that's the first step. Then in terms of, okay, well, yeah, I'm working on that, but how do I deal with the grief? How do, yeah, I deal with the rage? How do I deal with the fear? Okay, then there are two key parts. And you know this from your own work and from my book. One is to start small. It's, yeah, like so many of us, particularly if we're on a path, particularly if we practice meditation or some other form of spiritual cultivation, it's like we want to go right in there to the center. We want to get to the heart of it. And often with these powerful trance-like states, that's not helpful.
Yeah.
We just end up sinking. And so you think about, if you have a scrape or a wound or a cut, it heals from the edges.
Yeah.
And our hearts, our psyches are the same way. When we have these powerful, disturbing emotional experiences, they heal at the edges. We have to start small, just approach it a little bit, just touch into it for a moment or two, and then come back to your cup of tea, looking out the window, talking with your friend, listening to Al Green, whatever it is you're doing. So start small. And then the last principle, which I just referenced, is to move back and forth. This Peter Levine calls pendulation, like a pendulum swinging back and forth, as you move back and forth between something that feels okay and then the thing that's difficult. So the training and attention, changing the channel, this is the foundation of those steps. How do I get to okay? Mm-hmm. And then start small, take a break, go back, take a break. But the specific qualities in the book give us a whole range of ways You know, it's like, instead of having, you know, when you and I were growing up, we only had, I don't know, 7, 9 channels on TV,
right?
It was just 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, and 13 where I was.
Yep.
And then eventually cable TV came in. So, you know, most of us in our lives, we've just got even fewer. We've got, you know, 2 or 3 channels that we can flip between. You know, if we're trying to get out of something, it's like, I can eat something sweet or salty. You know, it's like I can get away from it by consuming some food, or turning on the TV, or whatever your go-to is, right? We've just got a few things like that. And some of them are sometimes not so helpful coping mechanisms, right? So what the book does is, it's like plugging into cable, where now you've got 26
channels, yes.
Channels that are actually healing.
Yeah.
They're not just distractions, but you can turn towards curiosity. You can tap into courage. You can attune to kindness. You can recollect how to be at ease or how to rest. You can find joy. You can tap into gratitude, wonder, generosity. There are all of these different ways to get back to okay enough.
Yeah, and I was going to talk about that in your chapters on energy and rest, which something I've frequently thought about this over the years, especially since the troubled years here that we've been recently living in, and that is just being or doing nothing. You know, you said at our age, I am significantly older than you are, I think.
You are, I think.
And at my age, before the internet, where I couldn't pick up a phone and doom scroll, and I couldn't flick through all my streaming services to find some escapism kind of thing. Even if it's a documentary, it's still me running away from myself. Just being was part of every one of my days. I remember this vividly. I remember very clearly how I used to do that. Like you said, just sit and look out the window. Oh, I did that a lot. Even when I was young, when we're talking, I remember in my 30s and 40s, I did that a lot. It wasn't like I was tired like I am now at 71. It was like, I just did that because there was not much else to do.
Yeah.
And so you would look at the birds and the squirrels, and I would watch the neighbors walk by. And this was, you know, just being time, right?
Yeah.
And even when I meditated then, but this was beyond the meditation period, just being. And sometimes I would read and read and read engrossed for hours, which I think none of us are able to do that much anymore because our attention span is so messed up.
Yeah.
So, and I have a vivid memory, and I think about this all the time, of watching my elderly neighbor clean the snow off his car.
Yeah.
He spent like 1 hour to do that, clean the snow off his car. But and he was doing it with like craftsman-like precision. And as he was doing that, you know, it occurred to me now in remembering it, I was watching him do that for an hour. Think about that.
Yeah.
Who would do that now? I mean, how did I know that he was doing it with a craftsman-like precision? Because I was watching him the whole time.
Yeah.
And one thing I remember this vividly.
Yeah.
You know, I did love my elderly neighbors. They're long since gone. But I remember as I watched him do that, my heart was expanding with love for him. Not because of any one thing, just because I was watching him do that.
Yeah.
And then you wrote, in a world on fire, taking time to rest is radical. We need to rest like that.
Yeah.
That could be one of our aspirations. It's a radical aspiration to just do that. And I don't know how many people could do that now.
Yeah. Well, I know who does that now.
Okay. You?
Children.
Children. No. Yes, you have a baby.
Children. This because it's innate. And this is the blessing. This is the thing that we need to keep coming back to and remembering, is that so much of this is innate. We just need to remember and find our way back. You know, one of the things that I do almost every day with my son now is we just walk out the front door and we wander and explore, you know, and we find a dandelion seed pod, or we find a little berry, or we find, you know, just a stick. Whoa, look at this stick. You
know, yeah, they
and,
love
then, and then we look up at the tree and, oh, it fell from up there. It's just the world is new and it's always new.
Right.
But we don't see it that way. We don't see what is. We see the past. We see through the filters of our past experiences and the filters of language. And so children can remind us how to do this, how to be in that state that you described so beautifully, of a kind of absorptive present and appreciation of the unfolding mystery of life.
Yeah. And you're right, kids. Yeah, it's amazing. I love to watch kids in the street. I mean, they run up and down the street in front of their mothers, and they always go for that stick. They always go for that stick, and it's just it is amazing. In parts three of your book, we talked about this. We've been talking a lot about the internal, but in parts three and four of your book, you talked about how to broaden or expand out the internal work or the internal transformation work that we're doing to social action. And can you do mention this in your book, but I want to open it up to the listeners. Can you talk, because when people think social action, especially I know people who are like my age, and they think, well, what social action I'm going to do? I'm not going to go protest or whatever, or people who are disabled, because I have a very ableist out, you know, I think about that all the time. So what other ways can people bring that internal transformation out to heal the world?
Yeah, thank you. What a beautiful question. And what would happen if we all asked that question in a sincere way and kept it alive as a koan?
Yeah.
You know, there's something just about the investigation that is onward leading. And I think it's a reflection of the maturity of our practice to look and see, because, you know, the natural expression of wisdom is compassion. Wisdom doesn't just see, it knows and it feels that we are not separate.
Yeah.
And therefore, when there is suffering, we reach out, we respond. Not because I should or I have to or what about, but simply because we're connected. That's the experience. So I appreciate that you're asking the question, not just because of that, but to make it real, to make it practical. And many of, you know, many of the practitioners I meet do not feel called to be out in the streets protesting, and yet do care very deeply about our world, our society, our government, issues of hunger and war and climate. And so there's so many ways to be involved and make a difference. And this is one of the gifts of being alive today, is that we get to participate. We get to discover what is the way that I want to engage and plug in. And so, you know, this could be anything from contributing to a community garden to helping to get out the vote, writing letters, making phone calls, engaging people in democracy. It could include things like sharing resources, learning about the climate crisis together with neighbors and friends and family, and watching a documentary and having a discussion. It can include finding out what's happening in your community and what are the needs that are present and how can you get involved, whether it's at an animal shelter or a homeless shelter or doing a cleanup by a stream or a river or a park. Even something as simple as carrying an extra bag with you when you go for walks and picking up trash, you know. And then it's a small gesture, but you know, where I live, the all the sewers drain to the bay. Mm-hmm. Anything on the sidewalk or the street is going to end up in the waterways and affect the wildlife. And you know, so when we do something like that, and someone, it has a direct effect on other beings. Someone sees us, it restores their faith in humanity, and then they do something mm-hmm. else. So there are many ways to do it. You know, making extra food when you cook dinner and bringing it to a family that just had a baby or that is struggling financially. These are the ways that we live together and that we support one another. And I think it's important to hold the both perspectives, both this kind of vast global perspective of everything that's happening, not to frighten us or feel helpless, but to remember that we do live in a broader context and the things we say and do matter. And then the very specific day-to-day actions.
Yeah.
And to really look at how am I living and what are the values that are animating my choices and actions and how can I align those more and more with the kind of world that that I want to leave behind for me.
Yeah, you know, there's the Bodhisattva vow about bringing all beings to enlightenment, which mm-hmm. seems like impossible, right? How in the world can I bring all beings mm-hmm. to enlightenment? That's sort of we talk about this a lot in my sangha because it's Mahayana based, and we talk a lot about being a Bodhisattva, and we're studying the way of the Bodhisattva now, so that's right in the forefront of my mind. And one of the commentaries we were using is a commentary written by Pema Chodron on she calls it Becoming Bodhisattva is a Guidebook to Compassionate Action. And she says that one of the things you need to realize about the Bodhisattva vow, about all beings means which being? In other words, is it the being that you're having a fight with right now?
Yeah.
Is it the being that's, you know, what being is that? All beings just mean it's like a sampling. In thinking about that one being is bringing all beings. Now we can go into the more, you know, Prajnaparamita outlook of it about, you know, once I get to Nirvana and I'm supposed to bring all beings to enlightenment, once I get there will be no beings, which essentially hints at the fact that my mind changed around the beings, that I brought them all there.
Right.
But I think that's one of the ways I thought of that about the social action is one of the ways I can do that is just not to like maybe pick somebody that I have a problem with, because we mm-hmm. all have, we're not all perfect, and there's all usually somebody that gets under our skin, right? Yeah. And so pick that one person and say, how can I think differently about that being?
Yeah. Or as Sharon Salzberg likes to say, just putting it in another way, it's like, do the good that's in front of you.
That's right. Exactly.
Do the good you can. Just see what is a way that I can contribute.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. We're getting close to the end of our time, and I don't want to push you too much on that hard stop. So is there anything else you'd like to bring up about your book? You know, I pull out questions that come to me as I'm reading a book, but there might be something that you would like my listeners to know that I didn't bring up.
Oh, thanks. Well, I mean, just to continue on this theme that we're talking about, Wendy, is just that reminder that we don't know the future. It is uncertain and it is unwritten. And rather than that being a cause for inaction or helplessness or hopelessness, it's quite the opposite. It's a cause for a very kind of practical hope, which is the faith that actions have effects and that we are all together today creating the future through our actions and our choices. And right. so to remember that we're not helpless, that we are actually, particularly when we act together, quite powerful to affect change. And so to really listen inside for, you know, what is it that's calling you? What is it that you feel called to do? Because there is so much need that none of us can do all of it. But there's also so much need that there's something for each of us to do.
Yeah.
So exactly. to find out what that is and do it.
Yeah. And that's the aspiration part that you begin the book with, really.
Right.
And that's a great anchor.
Yeah.
And also I will put links to your website, your books and everything
oh, yeah.
on the show notes,
but
Great. Is there a special event or a workshop or a presentation or something you'd like to promo here?
They're all special.
Okay. They're all special. Yeah. I shouldn't have said special.
No,
just
it's great.
Another one of Oren's special
well,
events.
I mean, I'm doing, I am teaching online regularly a couple times a month, often about the new book. And anyone and many, if not most of those events are all freely offered by donation. So yeah, come join me. All of my events are listed on my website, orinjsofer.com. And I usually post on social media about them as well. So I would be delighted to meet some of your listeners at the events. And but yeah, the last thing I would say is if the folks listening have found some value in our conversation, appreciate my perspective on things, one of the best ways to stay in touch is I have a small email newsletter. I send out a note once or twice a month with a teaching or a reflection. And so that's another way to connect.
Yeah, I was going to promo that because I'm on your mailing list. So
oh,
I
great.
I already know about that. So
wonderful.
I've got advance notice. So, okay. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for this wonderful book and the delightful conversation. I so appreciate you being here. Thank you, Oren.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Wendy.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Oren J. Sofer, and we'll check out his website, teachings, and books. You will find all the details in the show notes. Next up, as usual, some announcements. We recently began a new study in the Everyday Sangha, working with The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shante Deva through the companion book Becoming Bodhisattvas, a guidebook for compassion and action by Pema Chodron. The Sangha is a private, donation-supported group that meets virtually via Zoom every other week on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Our meetings consist of a service first, including traditional vow recitations and other invocations, chanting, and a short meditation period. The service introduces more ritual and liturgy into the structure of our meeting, much like you would find at a non-virtual Buddhist temple, church, or sangha. The service includes a Dharma talk by one of the practice leaders or myself, and possibly a Dharma glimpse by one of our Sangha members. After the service, we open it up to discussion of the current book study, or of anything that was inspired by one of the Dharma talks, or by life. Consider joining the Sangha at this time to be a part of the new study, practice, and part of a warm and welcoming Sangha community. You can learn more about the Sangha by viewing the bonus YouTube podcast where me, Bradley Janayo Sensei, and Terry Zenkai Hoskin, our practice leaders, talk about what the Sangha is and what everyday Buddhism is all about. You can also support this podcast and the other activities of everyday Buddhism by becoming a community member. If you do, you will have access to all members-only podcasts, an education series, the Introduction to Buddhism course, the Buddhist Book Club, and a private group on a non-Facebook platform. If you don't follow me or Everyday Buddhism on any social media platforms, you can go to the Everyday Buddhism website and join the membership community or the Everyday Sangha. go to www.everyday-buddhism.com and click on either the tab that says Join Members Community or Join Everyday Sangha. Or you can join through Patreon at patreon.com/everydaybuddhism. Links to joining the Everyday Sangha and membership community are also posted in the show notes. I thank all of you who contribute. This podcast, the community, and the Sangha depend on your donations to continue to exist. I don't seek sponsors for the podcast, and I don't ask for financial commitments or paid podcast memberships, so my work and the costs needed to support what I do is entirely self-funded, except for your donations. Please consider a one-time or continuing donation through Patreon or on my website's Donate tab. Or on the website, you can buy me a coffee on the Coffee Cup link. You can find the links in the show notes. And thanks to all of you who write in with comments and questions. I read all of your emails and may even pick your question to feature in a bonus podcast. Another way you can help is to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. It's important to share the podcast with others if you find it helpful in your life. And if you could, please take a minute to comment about it so people will know why you like Everyday Buddhism. That's it for all the announcements, so until next time, keep finding ways to make yours and everyone's days better.